All right. Welcome to a bonus episode of Talking Stocks. Joe and Todd with you as always. And today we have a special guest, Jessica Oblamski. Jessica is a marketing writer and journalist who is somewhat of a rising star in the FinTwit world. So we're very happy to have you here, Jessica. Thanks for joining us and welcome.
And pleasure to be here.
So why don't we start off by just, you can just give us a little bit of an overview of how you got into investing and how you got kind of where you are today.
Sure. So I think everybody who invests seems to, there are stock families and there are real estate families. I come from a stock family. My father is a very long-time investor. He's a very long-term buy-and-hold investor. He never sells anything. So I grew up hearing the rules of the market. Jess, you've got nothing till you sell. Something's only worth as much as somebody else is willing to pay for it. These very basic principles I've been hearing since long before I knew what they meant. But honestly, the idea of investing in the stock market always terrified me, believe it or not. I remember very well the tech bubble bursting. And I was just starting my career as the foreclosure crisis, you know, as that started blowing up when, you know, with Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, I remember doing stories about truckers who couldn't afford to drive their trucks off the lot. At one point, a third of the houses in the newer neighborhoods, mostly Hispanic neighborhoods, were at some phase of foreclosure. And I was just terrified. But, flash forward as the economy starts recovering, I finally was at the point, high quality problems, where I had more money sitting in the bank than I thought was necessary. So I was like, you know what? What the heck? Maybe I should start investing. And my brother, honestly, was a big part of that. My brother had been investing for years, and he kind of mentored me through the stock picking process. And I was very lucky because it was very high quality mentoring. He would, he would throw out usually about, you know, 3 to 5 names in a basket, like big tech or, the Chinese monopolies or the most hated stocks on the market, and tell me, do research, pick one.
Yeah, it's so important. Hi, Jessica. It's great to see you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And, I love your take on FinTwit. I love following you on Twitter. I think that any of you listeners, if you don't already follow Jessica, please do. Do yourself a favor. Maybe she'll make you some extra money. But, you know, I think it's so important, Jessica, to have mentors, people in, you know, that can help you shape early on just these basic skills. And then, you know, invariably, I always find that, you know, we kind of take our own path after a while. So, you know, here are some building blocks and some things that maybe you want to be considering. And then you sort of take that and you run with it and you make it your own. And I think that's so important with investing, is to find a strategy that matches your particular personality and approach and goals and all that, rather than just say, okay, I'm going to blindly copy and follow in someone's lead. And one of the things that I always love to find out when I'm talking to investors is, you know, what are the things that make you sing? What makes a stock jump out to you? You know, I'm a big believer in practices and processes and rules and systematic investing. And I think that there are certain check marks on boxes that I like to go through, but not everybody invests that way. So I'd love if you could just tell me a little bit more on how you find stocks that you want to add to your portfolio.
Sure. Well, I'm a writer, so I am very attracted to a good story. I agree completely that you have to find a strategy that works for you, not just your personality, but also your skill set. I actually have a occupational hazard. I've done work in a lot of different industries, so my knowledge tends to be I tend to have a very broad-based knowledge in a lot of things, but I am an expert in only a few of them. So
you're a generalist. You'd consider yourself to be a generalist.
Yes, I really like I like e-commerce. I don't think I have any edge on the market there. I just think that the runway is incredibly long, and e-commerce makes sense to me. I do really like health tech. That is one of my areas of expertise. I also really like real estate. I've got a lot of background in education. Unfortunately, there hasn't been a lot I've been interested in education, although I am toying with Kahoot. The valuation will make your eyes water, but it's the first kind of education-oriented stock I've been interested in. I have tried to stick with the things I am capable of understanding. There are a lot of amazing stocks out there that are just require a kind of technical expertise that I'm not interested in developing.
So do you think it's fair to say that step one is it's got to be within your wheelhouse?
I do. If something is going to be outside your wheelhouse, you have to really trust the people who are recommending the stock. You've got to really trust them, or maybe be very process oriented. If you're a trend follower, then you know what? Do your thing. You don't need a wheelhouse, really. You just follow the trend, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's just not the way I invest. I particularly like stocks that other people aren't convinced about yet. Left for dead growth stocks. Once upon a time, everybody's forgotten how much they hated Pinterest, but it really wasn't that long ago. Everybody hated Pinterest. Etsy, same way. Etsy and Pinterest were basically left for dead. The iBuying stocks, all of a sudden, there's still a bit of a battleground, but all of a sudden, everybody's super interested in iBuying. When I started, when I went all in on Zillow, basically everybody thought I was crazy. And there's a real danger there because the market's always right. And I recognize that the market is always right. If you are going to go all in on something the market hates, you need a very strong thesis. I think that's incredibly important. I got lucky with the stocks I just mentioned because they took off almost immediately after I bought them. But that's not always the case. I held JD for years before it paid off.
So yeah, that's interesting. And when you mentioned before that you like growth stocks, or at least these areas of the market tend to be growth stocks.
Yes.
But then you're also saying, I kind of like them when they're left for dead. So would you say that you're, how do you reconcile, or how do you approach that? Are you looking for a certain amount of growth? Like, does it have to, or is it just that, okay, I kind of feel like this is something that's going to be really big in a few years. So
that one, I mean, I do prefer making money. that is ideally what I'm trying to do here is make money. But, honestly, like you said earlier, you have to find a style that works for you. And I am a little bit contrarian by nature. When everybody really likes something, I start getting nervous. I mean, in real life too, that's just how I am. Honestly, I'm not much of a joiner. So when Etsy and Pinterest, the numbers looked, obviously Etsy and Pinterest growth became more impressive after the March crash and the shutdown. Nonetheless, look at the charts. The growth was there. I think Etsy and Pinterest were honestly held back by Wall Street being very male dominated, and I don't mean this I mean this very objectively. Stocks like Etsy, Lulu, Once Upon a Time, Wall Street doesn't always get stocks that women love, and they tend to lag the market, but when they catch up, it's just fire. The market, actually, I think catches up quicker on, stocks that lag the market because there's something women are very interested in, I think they actually catch up relatively quickly. So if you pay attention to the things that, you know, your mother, your girlfriend, your wife, your friends, pay attention to those things because they're worth looking at.
Yeah, I think I remember you saying something about Progyny at one point. Was for a similar reason, or one of those stocks. It just kind of the under radar, but not to you necessarily.
Yes.
Under the radar, maybe to this historically male dominated kind of industry, but not under the radar to you. So, I mean, keep your mind open to all of these different opportunities and try to buy, you know, growth on sale, if you will.
Pinterest is a fantastic example. I mean, I knew very, very few women who did not use Pinterest. Pinterest was a no-brainer for me. And the fact that the market hated it was just a bonus. I think Zillow, Redfin, and now Open are good examples. Residential real estate has never been disrupted. A lot of investors think it never will be, but if they're wrong, the upside is massive.
Yeah, that's a great point. When you were going back for a second on the on your point of pay attention to companies that your wife or your girlfriend or your mom are big into, what popped into my mind was Stitch Fix. I don't know if you necessarily agree, but it seems to really fit that bill for me. I've owned it on and off myself, and it was definitely left for dead for some time, and then very recently broke out and really has broken out into new highs now.
Revolve is another good example. I mean, it's just been on a beautiful run very recently, for about, you know, I think a month and a half now, just beautiful run it's having. And it's got a lot to prove, but Revolve is another good example of something that had been left for dead. And we'll see how it performs over, you know, the actual results we'll see over the next year. But I've said it a lot on Twitter, and I'm going to keep saying it. If you want an edge on Wall Street, brands, platforms, trends that appeal to women, that's a really good way to get an edge on Wall Street.
Jessica, let me jump in real quick, and just for listeners that haven't, maybe aren't familiar with Revolve, can you give us a quick, you know, 10,000 foot elevator pitch on what their business is?
Sure. So Revolve uses events, influencers, social media to promote high-end clothing sales. It's kind of in the same category as Farfetch, but it's a lot more reliant on events, which is why it took a massive hit, not just the stock price, but also growth since the pandemic started.
So if you don't mind me jumping in here, I'd love to hear if you have some ideas of these growth stocks that might be kind of in that left for dead stage right now.
That might
break out. What was that?
Encino.
Got it. And what do they do? I've personally never heard of them. I'm guessing some viewers and listeners haven't either.
Sure. So it's an interesting company. People have described it like, I don't know how familiar your viewers are with Viv. But it's kind of been, Veeve is like, let me take a step back. So Veeve is like CRM for life sciences, and, and stock ticker NCNO has been described as like Veeve for banking. So it's an interesting case. Growth was just, there are mounting losses, but growth was on fire until the pandemic. And the stock price is very fairly taken a hit. I mean, the guidance was very, very, very weak. And I don't have a position presently, but I suspect in terms of fund, I don't know, you know, it's about to, lockup is about to expire, I believe, maybe this week, very soon. So the stock price could keep going down. But in terms of fundamentals, I think we might be nearing a bottom. It's still not cheap. Even now, after having come down, this is not a cheap stock. However, I think in terms of fundamentals, we might be nearing a bottom.
It's interesting that you say that, Jessica. There's a whole bunch of stuff to unpack on that stock. I mean, you don't own it now, but you do think that maybe it's beat up and it could be offering opportunity.
Yes.
Historically, you know, stocks will sell off prior to, you know, heading into the lockup. And then once the lockup happens, that overhang is gone, the stock will naturally rise up. You mentioned that you like to look at growth stocks. You like to look at growth stocks when maybe they're a little bit out of favor. And this is a stock theoretically that you have on a watch list that you might be interested in buying. It doesn't sound like you're very worried about profitability. You know, you mentioned that, you know, that there's losses and you don't necessarily care. I'm generalizing, right? I mean, we all care about it. You'll probably watch the trend on that. I don't want to put words in your mouth. But I'd be curious. So I guess that's a good question. Do you care about earnings and profitability? And are you looking at trends and changes in the profitability? And I guess, what would it be that you'd be looking for to finally want to pull the trigger and buy something like an NCNO?
Sure. First of all, I do care about profitability. I do expect if I buy stock in an unprofitable company, I do expect that it will be profitable eventually. But if I'm going to buy a stock that is unprofitable, I would prefer to see those losses be, it is acceptable to me if those losses are due to fueling future growth. I would prefer R&D over marketing. That's where you start losing me a little bit. If you're spending $2 in marketing, in sales and marketing, just to make a dollar in profit, I get a little bit nervous. But even marketing, I mean, sometimes it depends on the company. Sometimes that is incredibly important. DraftKings is a good example of that, with the kind of terrifying marketing expenses, but it's for a reason. So profitability is important to me. I would like to see them be profitable eventually. But let's be honest, when you're not sure what's going to happen, that's when the market isn't sure what's going to happen, that's when you make the real money. Of course, you might be wrong. So size accordingly. If you're really not sure, size accordingly. I have an iBuying basket, which is very rare for me. I usually go all in on one stock, but for Zillow, Redfin, Open, I've got a basket. I genuinely believe that it's too early to go all in on one stock. I think anything can happen over the next decade.
Yeah, absolutely. When you say all in, do you actually mean all in, or do you just mean a large portion of your holdings?
That's a good question. This isn't Wall Street. I don't run my portfolio like Wall Street bets. So
that's smart.
All in, all in for me. I've been tempted occasionally, but risk management is real. It's important.
Absolutely.
All in for me is a full position.
All right.
All in for me might sometimes be a full position plus a bullish options position, but that kind of depends on the stock and the market. If something I love has gotten too cheap to ignore, if the chart looks good, then I might do a full position plus a bullish options position. Sometimes I'll do a bullish options position to kind of dip a toe in before starting a full position.
So just to follow up on that, how much of your capital do you think you would have at risk in a particular stock? I mean, I think one of the things that a lot of investors wrestle with is how many stocks do I want to own? And how much should I be exposed to that single stock risk? So I'd be curious to see how you manage that, especially since it sounds like you're managing it both with options and with stock, but I'd be curious to hear from you how you're managing that, how you approach that.
Sure. So I have a hard cap on initial investment. I have no cap beyond that. Look, the market's been swinging around like crazy. So what I tend to do is, you know, I do about 5%, 5% cap on initial investment for something that I am looking at as core portfolio, long-term investment. But after that, I kind of ignore the swings. I mean, look, if my portfolio is up 20% a month later, I'm not going to increase the cap. You know, I increase the cap slowly to kind of even out, you know, even out some of those swings. Ideally, I want the same initial amount of, the same amount of money invested into each of my core positions.
I'm a big believer in letting winners run. And it sounds like you're also a big believer in letting winners run. I know one of my favorite things is your pinned tweet, you know, where you say lessons that I learned this year, and the trend is your friend was one of them. However, that bridges to the next question, which is simply, okay, you talked or you hinted a little bit about your risk control. And your risk control, you're using sizing as a big component of your risk control. And you also mentioned, listen, if something goes up 20%, I'm not going to add to it. I guess the next natural question would be is, when would you be considering selling it? What do you do both for winners and for losers? Like, how do you handle the I'm wrong? We're all wrong, right? Well, none of us are perfect. We're going to lose money here and there. So I'd love to hear how you're approaching that beyond just sizing.
Sure. It depends on whether we're talking about, options I use as an extension of my investing. However, we're still talking about things that are primarily a trade. And if we're talking about a trade, whether it's very short term, or I don't usually day trade except by accident. But if we're talking about a day trade, a swing trade, or an options position, when in doubt, you know, just get out now. And that's my philosophy on trading. I don't have if I know going in, this is a trade, or if I was just dipping a toe in and then I'm like, oh God, no, I was wrong. Then I have a very low tolerance for swings. Core positions are very, very different. For a core position, ideally, I don't get out until my thesis breaks. But if I decide my thesis is broken, I will take a couple of times very large losses to get out. I am pretty stubborn with a core position. I was underwater in JD because of the trade war for, I don't know exactly how long, but it was until the crash. I was underwater in JD, and I just kept holding. But I did take a large loss on Baidu to get out. I had been concerned about it for some time, and I finally, I don't remember which one, I think it was a couple of years ago already, I listened to an earnings call, and I'm like, you know what? They're just throwing stuff at the wall to see what sticks. And that is not an appropriate, in my opinion, that was not an appropriate way to run your business. And I don't remember what the loss was, but it wasn't 5%.
Yeah, it was probably a big number, right? Yeah.
It was a decent size loss. Grub is another one. Grub is, that's an industry I got burned so bad, I might never touch it again.
Me too.
High five. So yeah, I took a sizable loss on Grub to get out. But
yeah, I think it's important to do that. I think that a lot of times, I think the calculus that you have to do, the temptation is to say, I'm going to sit back because I'm going to get bailed out. I'm going to get proven right. Well, and you've said this, and I think it's actually, I don't know sure if it's your pin Twitter, but I'd rather win than be right, right? I mean, you've got to be willing to say to yourself, what's my opportunity cost? You know, because if I sell that name, I have money now that I can use to deploy into a different name, theoretically. It's not a zero-sum game where it's just like going to hold it in cash, right? I mean, there's always probably ideas that are coming up on your radar. So I think that makes a tremendous amount of sense. It's tough. I mean, you mentioned thesis, right? When you have a thesis. So when you're building your thesis, is it very macro-y kind of oriented where you're saying to yourself, I really believe that, well, obviously you were interested in Pinterest before COVID and increased usage because of that. So I mean, I guess I'm curious, when you're forming your thesis, because it's such an important part of your long-term holds, how are you doing that? What are you using to put that together?
Well, like I said, I started as a newspaper reporter. It's the art of brevity. So my theses tend to be similarly short and sweet. You know, like with Zillow, Redfin, and Open, if investors are wrong and there is an opportunity for disruption in iBuying, the upside is massive. My thesis on Teladoc, which is my highest conviction hold actually after Amazon, if that might tell you just how high my conviction is in Teladoc. My thesis is telehealth is the future. That's really the whole thesis. Telehealth is the future, because it is the future in my humble opinion. You know, my thesis on Pinterest has not changed. If management continues to execute, because I think they were executing even when the market hated them, if Pinterest continues to execute, it is a cash cow.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. Teladoc is the future. There are lots of smaller players in the industry, and they're very clearly set up to be the future industry titan. We've talked about them on the show a couple times before. So I want to shift gears a little bit, and we do this every week on the show. Our regular viewers and listeners are well aware of this. Todd likes to give us his signature smattering of stocks across any industry, any market cap, just things that, you know, he may own or is interested in buying at the right price. Mm-hmm. So I would love to pose that question to you. However many kind of come to mind, you know, if you just want to list off a bunch of names, that's totally cool. If you want to, you know, give us your thesis behind them, that's great as well. But I'll let you take that where you wish.
Sure. So right now I'm building a position in GoodRx. GoodRx is in telehealth, but its primary flywheel is discounts on pharmaceutical drugs. I think it's got, you know, even here, I think it's got a reasonable shot at being a monster, you know, at being a monster of going 10x over the next decade. It's not a sure thing. Nothing's a sure thing, but I've liked GoodRx actually since before it went public. I heard about it from my healthcare contacts, and it just blew my mind, and I was really excited when it went public. So
Jessica
finally dipped a toe in there.
It's just to throw in some support in the healthcare as general. I know you have kind of a health tech interest anyways.
Yes.
Is there a sector more at need for disruption than healthcare? Right? I mean, we talk about Teladoc, and you also are very fond of GoodRx now. I mean, yes. This is a sector that is just so ripe for disruption. None of their systems talk to one another. It's just such a broken model.
Healthcare, yeah. It's probably the one thing you're going to get most Americans to agree on is that healthcare is broken.
Absolutely.
So there are a lot of opportunities in health tech. The one thing I would caution people is buyer beware. You should always be wary. However, there is a massive opportunity in healthcare, and we know what happens with massive opportunities. they attract not just mediocrity, but also scams. So I would be, over the next decade, I think we're already seeing an increasing number of opportunities of companies taking advantage of this opportunity. But I think now is the time to start getting really selective, in my opinion.
Yeah, totally agree. So continuing with the smattering.
yes. So I guess if we want to continue with health tech, that said, totally. So I've got a small position in HMI. It is they do primarily wearables. Also, they've smart home gym equipment. It is a Chinese ADR. I know a lot of people won't touch them. I don't have that. I've talked about JD enough, but obviously I don't have that feeling. So HMI is an interesting company. It's got actually a lot of market share in wearables, smartwatches, but despite improved fundamentals, the stock price really hasn't kept up. I mean, the stock price has done basically nothing since the IPO. It spikes and then it goes back to a base and then it spikes again. I think opportunity cost is real, but this is one where if fundamentals continue to improve, the market can't ignore it forever. The market can stay irrational a lot longer than you can stay solvent. But this is one where I'm willing to take the risk of the opportunity cost because I think there could be a real opportunity there. But again, this is a very small position for me.
Right. And I think it's an interesting one. Jessica, to your point, you've said before your max position would be 5%.
Yeah.
So I mean, you can, you know, even if you're not doing a full max position on something, you can afford to take that little bit of a risk. Is that kind of what you're saying, is that maybe this isn't a 5% position for me, it's a little bit smaller?
I mean, let's be honest, I have huge gains. I can afford to be wrong for a while. There are a lot of gains in the portfolio. I got very lucky last March. I think my max drawdown was like 4 or 5%. So I've had a really good couple of years. I can afford to be patient with a very small position.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting on that HMI stock. I was just punching it up really quickly on my system. And I mean, this is a company with 1.2 billion in trailing 12 months. Well, if you analyze last quarter sales,
yes.
1.2 billion in sales. And the market cap is only around, I want to say like 800 million, 850 million.
Yeah.
So to your point, not really being reflected potentially in what's going on. And could be that overhang, kind of like that forgotten, beaten up idea that nobody's really paying attention to now. But at some point, they will be, because overall they'll eventually get attracted to the size of the market that they're targeting and the growth rate. Is that kind of the thinking?
HMI is clearly being valued like a low margin hardware stock, but let's keep in mind, it really wasn't that long ago that Apple was valued like a low margin hardware stock. Not that I'm saying HMI is the next Apple, but it's an example of stories change.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Just awesome. Awesome. Any other particular final stocks that are on your radar right now that might be worth people punching up on their watch list?
The things I've been looking at lately are fairly speculative. I don't know how deep into it's kind of the theme these days, but I don't know how deep into high risk your listeners want to get. But I am toying with Kahoot. That chart is just beautiful. The valuation will make your eyes water. Honestly, I really just need to start playing the games. If any of your listeners are interested in that, the basic services in two of their, you know, it for home and also school are free. So they can actually make accounts there. And what else? And I just took a very small position in an OTC stock called Engage Gaming. It's That is an interesting one. I think I have the same size position as HMI, so relatively small, but it's really interesting. They do, they have an esports league, they do esports, they also create content for gamers, and it's like the biggest company nobody's ever heard of.
Do you happen to know the symbol off the top of your head for Engage?
E, N is in Nancy, G is in Gamer, M, F is in Frank.
Perfect.
And I'm not trying
to... On the OTC stocks, I mean, you can find some interesting names, OTC, and they are kind of under the radar. To your point, seems like that's something that is really cool to try to find these ideas. And, you know, esports, you're right. I mean, that seems to be where this whole market is going. I mean, people are getting more increasingly competitive with one another online, this is a huge business that no one would have thought of 10 years ago, you know, that this is just this blowing up now, the competitions and everything.
It's amazing. If the thing that always amazes me about the internet is just how many people like that thing you've never heard of. And just because you haven't heard about it and it's not, and actually this goes back to pay attention to this, to the brands, platforms, and trends that the women you love are into. Just because it's not important to you doesn't mean it's not investable.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. One of the things when you started mentioning esports is it's a real shame that Amazon picked up Twitch so early, because that would be right up there with, I think, with some of the huge names right now in FinTwit, not necessarily the biggest market cap, but you know, the Pinterest and Datadog and stuff like that for sure.
Absolutely, I can't even imagine what between Twitch and Discord. Can't even imagine.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not a gamer, but my significant other is. So these are things I hear about a lot.
Yes, absolutely. All right. So with that, assuming that Todd, you don't have any further questions or any wrap up questions.
No, you know, Jessica, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and chat and to talk stocks. It's always a blast to be able to talk to people in this venue. I suppose that's one of the great things about FinTwit and just about technology overall, is that, you know, you get to meet all these wonderful people and talk about all these different approaches to there's no one size fits all, right? There's so many different ways that we can go out and make money. And it's just, I've always found it fascinating to talk to people, especially people that I engage with on Twitter and I really enjoy. So if you're not following Jessica on Twitter yet, we'll make sure that we have a link in the show notes so that you can make sure that you can get over there and give her a follow, because some really good content. I think you'll find some really interesting stuff.
Yes, we sure will. The handle is Jay Oblamski. I'll put that in the show notes along with everything we've talked about. Jessica, is there anything you want to leave us with? Anything at all?
I think nobody likes the risk management tweets, but the one thing I'll say is don't forget to sell your losers, because nobody's right all the time.
Totally. I 100% agree. Well, it's been great talking with you, Jessica. With that, viewers and listeners, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.